but
not a whole bunch. I beat Zelda.
Oh, I don't want to hear anything about it.
All right. But that took some time, and then I've been reading to catch up since.
Was it satisfying?
Yes, narratively satisfying. And then I looked at the game and I completed under 25% of it, so...
Oh, wow.
I'm not done with it. I just finished the narrative.
Do they only tell you that percentage after you beat it, or can you check it at any time?
I don't know. It's on my Sheikah map now, in the lower left-hand corner. I don't know if that's on there before you beat it or not.
I'll have to look. I always feel like... when I'm playing through a game like this, I want to obsessively do everything, but if I finish the narrative, I lose my desire to do so.
I'm surprised that hasn't happened to me, but the only reason I did do it so fast is because Java was on vacation for a week, and I'm like, this is my time.
But I wonder if that'll be different in this game, because I've never played a game where I have so much fun just wandering around and being a part of this world and shopping and cooking and all that shit.
Yeah, I thought I got a lot of shit done, and then for it to be like under 25%, I was like, oh. So I spent most of the day just like wandering around in my off moments.
I wish that they showed how many hours you spend, but they don't.
I think they have a rough estimate on your friend profile, because mine is over 65 is what it says. So I don't know when it updates that, or if it just goes to 65 and then lets you have some dignity.
On your friend profile, eh?
Yeah.
I mean...
whatever your profile is.
I'm going pretty slowly on purpose. I assume, I went to the sand place first as my first of the four divine beasts. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go there. And I'm in the divine beast right now. But I assume that each of the four realms takes a fair bit of time.
Yeah. And if you did the sand one first, that one's tough because of all the atmospheric stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's a real pain in the ass.
Yeah, when you can travel and sit.
Before I did this one, I went just into a bunch of random shrines that I could find, running around, because I'm big into just collecting horses and just riding them around. And I killed the third challenge shrine, I think, a lot of hours before I was supposed to. And so I got some, really beefy weapons, and that has made things easier.
Yeah, it's and then once you start, because each divine beast that you defeat gives you another ability, and once you have those abilities, different parts of the world get easier to get to. Yeah, still super fun. That's the report of how I'm doing.
And then in the DLC, you can get a motorcycle. You can get, I don't know, there's all sorts of shit.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't even thought about doing the DLC, but I'll save that for when I do something worthwhile in my real life, I'll reward myself.
I'm deluding myself into thinking that I will have any time to use this at Sundance by bringing it along with me. And it's just going to end up tempting me, the fucking One Ring, as I've got nine reviews piling up.
You're like, or I could climb that mountain I've been waiting to climb.
Yeah, I just want to fucking climb the mountain and then glide off and... and then, I stumbled over a giant rock monster somehow, and everything is trouble. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of things you just stumble across that kind of kill you immediately.
Did you run into the giant rock monster?
I've run into a giant rock monster, and then I've run into a couple of things, but the only one that was as shocking as the giant rock monster is, have you run into, a centaur yet?
No.
They are bad news.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, number 197 for Tuesday, January 16th. And on this day in 1974, the novel Jaws by Peter Benchley was published, that of course would form the basis for a little movie also called Jaws.
Meg. Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. This is the year Meg comes out, isn't it? Isn't this the year finally we're going to get to see Meg?
Is that true? I'm so fucking excited. I feel like we've been promised a Meg movie since I was like 10 years old. Also, was it, there may have been like a Meg miniseries made for like a really on the cheap in the 90s sometime. Or maybe I'm making that up. But I have vague memories. But like it would be Sci-Fi Channel worthy now by today's standards. But
so this is the year apparently we're going to get the Meg. August 10th, 2018.
Oy. I mean, I'm sure it'll be a disaster, but like, what if they just like do a really sober, what if like Anton Corbin takes like the same approach he took to the American, to Meg, not that Anton Corbin is directing this movie. I'm just like deep in my fantasies now. And we get a hyper severe, very brooding, existential Meg.
Starring Jason Statham.
Also, on this, the most free form of Fighting in the War Room episodes, I feel, because it's just you and me tonight, baby, in case everyone out there has yet to cotton on to that. And we'll get to why in a second. Spoiler alert, it's because everyone else is dead.
Between Two Daves episode.
Between Two Daves. I feel comfortable in just going on a tangent about that shark that they found a couple of months ago who may be like 500 years old. Crazy. Mm-hmm. Crazy. I bet you it's a detail in Meg. I mean, Meg, of course. I mean, maybe this is just like not even a point to crow over because it's so obvious because Meg is this prehistoric creature. But they'll be like, she's been swimming around there for 10 million years or something crazy like that.
Maybe global warming wakes it up somehow. So it's like Jason Statham versus the environment as personified by a... Or has Sharknado already run that into the ground?
I don't know. I'll go one further and say, at this point, if global warming isn't the culprit for what wakes Meg up, then the film is probably whiffed. Like, that seems like such a slam dunk to mix my sports metaphors that it's... I don't know what else you would do.
The ocean rises, and with it, terror.
Yes.
And only Jason Statham can stop it.
Also, it's the best case. It's our best hope for getting Donald Trump thread about how Meg is fake news. Global warming would never bring a prehistoric shark back from its dormant slumber.
Have you seen the Twitter joke about somebody betting a reporter like $300 to ask Trump about Wakanda?
I have indeed, and I would love to if only Trump would ever give a press conference. That would be high on our list of priorities. And it's not as though he would respond with anything of substance to any questions about pressing actual concerns. So I say why not?
Just give it a go. I'm interested in what the president thinks is real. I think for the first time. Maybe in my lifetime. Usually I'm interested in what the president does. Now I'm not so interested in that. But what does it look like from inside that skull?
I'm still hung up on a tweet from someone however many months ago that Trump's presidency confirms that we've already had a recent alien dust up, which I'm skeptical about after doing some deeper reading in the New York Times, but not that I was skeptical to begin with, but that if aliens were real and the government knew about them, we would all know by now because Trump would not be able to keep his fucking mouth shut for like 10 seconds. So I think there's a lot that we've been able to rule out from being true just by virtue of the fact that he hasn't spoken to it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You're, of course, listening to Fighting in the War Room, the show about pop culture.
And aliens.
I have two other hosts on this show, but Katie Rich has the flu, and David, why is Matt Patches not here?
Katie Rich has the flu, and Matt Patches has a baby.
Yeah.
When I said earlier that they were dead, I lied. It's the opposite. They are alive, creating life, propagating the species. There's now another Patches in the world. If you notice a disturbance in the Force over the weekend, that is why. Born, I'm told, after a Filmstruck marathon induced Matt's wife Michelle into labor. A Michael Haneke film pushed her over the edge. And so Eleanor said Patches was birthed into this world on a wave of icy terror.
Ooh, a wave of icy terror.
Yeah.
So in between babies and an unusually strong flu season, it's just going to be the two of us. I don't know how your week's been. My week has been full with a lot of reading because I do this other podcast, Storm of Spoilers, and we're going to try to do only our second ever book episode. We did a Stephen King episode, and some people kind of didn't like that because it's hard to get into everything about Stephen King, and people want you to be completionist. But we're going to try again with Michael Crichton, so I've been trying to read as many Michael Crichton books as I can in a week.
You know what Michael Crichton book really sucks? Like, it sucks so hard that no one even made it into a movie. Airframe.
I have not read it.
It's like the definition, quite literally, of like airport trash, but that's a terrible book.
Yeah.
No disrespect to Michael Crichton.
So I haven't been huge on digesting media. Luckily, you're going to fill me in a little bit on Paddington 2, and I want to get some of your cranberries memories. But first, apparently we have a review.
We do have a review. We have a review from Seeking Sarasvati, who says, breath, depth, and debate for the win. I recently added this podcast to my weekly listening list following my absolutely love for their sister podcast, Storm of Spoilers. I really love the differing perspectives and the broad spectrum of topics covered. While Dave Seven is my personal favorite of the contributors, although I think that Seeking Sarasvati is coming at that with a little bit of bias. I find myself taking various people's sides throughout the show and often inserting my own opinions out loud, which can be funny since I often listen in the university library. People give you strange looks. The dynamism of the relationships between the hosts makes me happy to listen to them discuss topics/properties about which I'm not particularly interested, and sometimes they even convince me to branch out. At this point, it's safe to say I'll be listening to this podcast for as long as it's around and highly recommend checking it out. Well, thank you very much, Seeking Sarasvati. That review was very helpful, and I have some good news for you. As you may have gleaned from earlier in this episode, we are now halfway towards creating a new generation of Fighting in the War Room podcast hosts that can carry on our noble work for us after we're gone.
Oh, so, yeah, like some sort of dynasty. So some are inherited, yeah, and some, I don't know, I'll pass mine down through an artifact like the Master Sword, and yes, together a new Fighting in the War Room.
And 100 years from now, when Calamity Marvel, whatever the fuck, rises back from the grave, are the next generation of heroes can rise to defeat it.
I think it's probably going to be Calamity Mickey Mouse at this point. That seems seems pretty, yeah, fitting.
Yeah. And if I had trouble reading that or speaking in general, I'd like to think that it's because I've just been so immersed in Zelda Breath of the Wild for the past week, where overwhelmingly people don't speak in human words, but just hup, hup, or like,
hey,
just like hey, or like high-pitched moans of surprise, and I've just decided that has overtaken my ability to communicate with words.
Yeah, that used to happen to me when I would play The Sims a lot to make myself feel better. Be like, this life has order, but then it's like it's Simish starts taking over your thoughts.
Yeah, I wonder if David Sims, from friend of the podcast, of co-host of Blank Check, is related to the other Sims. I've never asked him that before.
David Sims of the computer Sims.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can imagine. Basically, next time you see him, look for that glowing green shape over his head. then we'll know for sure.
It's a valid question. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a movie that Eleanor Patches might be able to see in a few years, might need to see in a few years. People have asked me if this movie is okay for their kids? And I have responded that no, it is mandatory for their kids. I think their children, there's a very good chance that your children may not be okay if they don't see this movie.
So the original Paddington 1, isn't it, is now known, also got like a similar reaction. I didn't actually get around to seeing it. I have more children in my life now than I did back then. But apparently that first one was a family movie that could also be enjoyed by adults for being adorably cute. And this sequel, you're saying, is the same thing, even though everybody was kind of worrying about it getting dumped because it is a Weinstein Company movie.
Au contraire, mon frère, that is not what I'm saying.
Oh.
I am saying that Paddington 1 is an adorable film that I saw in theaters on a cold Saturday afternoon in January with my now wife many moons ago, and we had a lovely time. But Paddington 2 is not the same thing. Paddington 2, if I may speak in language that I think children will understand and appreciate, makes Paddington 1 look like fucking dog shit. Paddington 2 is a masterpiece. I would say that it's sort of analogous to the relationship between Magic Mike, which was fine and appreciated and I think a surprising hit that people enjoyed, and Magic Mike XXL, which is a timeless classic that will be enjoyed by our children and their children and their children's children's children for as long as we can stop ourselves from nuking each other. Paddington 2 is I mean, it's hard to talk about, I find, because I'm a 33-year-old adult man. I talk less on this show than on Twitter, but on Twitter with a lot of sarcasm and irony. And I think there's certain irony cloaked around the way that we've talked about certain – not we, but others in the film world have talked about certain movies that people might not expect them to enjoy so much. Most recently, something like The Greatest Showman. And maybe this week in The Commuter, although there is a community of like hardcore, how may I call it, Sarah fetishists. And I know people sincerely enjoy The Greatest Showman. I'm like halfway there. But I do think, as people pointed out to me on Twitter, there is a difference between, I would like to think, and this is me just enforcing my own beliefs about these films, I suppose, but I do think that the hoopla around The Greatest Showman in some circles has felt pretty forced. While those songs are catchy as fuck and the movie is demented, I think that it's people just having a good time and enjoying this like weirdo surprise hit film that has no right to exist. But Paddington 2 is sincerely, sincerely, sincerely great. It is a hard lock for my end of the year list, and there are a lot of spots on that list, 25, but it's certainly going to be on there. If I see, I mean, it's unfathomable that I would see 25 films that I enjoyed more than this in a given year. It's hard to imagine I'll see 10. It was for me at least, a really rapturous experience that I felt sort of as moved by in its way as any of the movies that I've proselytized about so incessantly that it has made people not only annoyed with me, but less interested in seeing the movies. It's a fine line to walk, but I definitely have been trying to do service journalism of some kind and like actually there's a rare satisfaction as a movie critic who does not think that criticism should be advocacy or consumer advocacy, that like in this case with the movie that's underperforming at the box office, to like individually speak to people and say, go see this movie right now, leave your house, go to a theater, take someone you love, spend some money and report back. And it's been really thrilling for me in a silly small way to see people take that advice and to a person come back and say how delightful this film was. Paddington 2, as you probably know, Paddington, little bear from darkest Peru. Don't worry about the fact that he can speak perfect English with an English accent. Nobody else does, which is very charming. He has found his way to London, where he lives with an adoptive family that is parented by Hugh Bonneville and Sally Hawkins. And they have two kids, two human kids. And it's just about their crazy misadventures. In this movie, Paddington decides that he wants to get a birthday present for Aunt Lucy, his bear aunt, who's still back in Peru, for her 100th birthday. And he's agonizing over what would be the right birthday present for this bear he loves so much. And he finds it in Jim Broadbent, Natch, his antique store collect, you know, his store that he has on Portobello Road. And it's a pop-up book of London. And he's like, oh, Aunt Lucy's always wanted to come to London, which is something that's established in the first film. And she would love this. But the conniving, what the fuck is this character's name? Phoenix something, Hugh Grant, Paddington 2. Help me out here, internet. Why is this not as easy as it should be? Whatever. His last name's Phoenix. That's all you need to know. Phoenix Buchanan. His first name's Phoenix. I apologize. A actor who has fallen off the map is an aging actor, a real hammy actor. And nobody likes him, so nobody wants to work with him. So his dream is to have a one-act play. He discovers that there is something in this pop-up book that is very valuable, a treasure map of sorts. And so using an elaborate series of disguises, he steals the treasure map, steals the book rather, frames Paddington for it, sends Paddington to jail, a bear cub in jail. And hilarity and heartwarmingness ensues. This is the sweetest movie I think could possibly ever be made. It is a not at all subtle or unambiguous rebuttal to Brexit era politics and the xenophobia and jingoism that have made those policies possible. It takes place in a London where Paddington, being the sort of refugee immigrant who's come into this community and made it all the better, he is seen in a beautiful opening scene that fluidly takes us through his neighborhood and reminded me a lot of the one take in Shaun of the Dead where he goes to the supermarket and back, or just the regular market, the bodega and back, and has that sense of sort of holistic quality to it. We see how he has brightened the lives of all the people who happen to be of all shapes, races, creeds, colors, and sizes who live in his neighborhood, except for the one old Doctor Who actor, whatever his name is, who has like a Fox News old Bush era government threat meter that he uses to judge Paddington's activity. And Paddington is just this really positive source. He may come from what Trump would deem a shithole country, but he is bringing so much more with him to London, and he goes to prison and has such a beautiful effect on the surliest bastards in the world, including Brendan Gleeson as the hard-ass cook Knuckles McGinty. There's not a single moment in this movie where I was not smiling or laughing or then at the end just straight up weeping. The visual imagination that Paul King, the director who made the television series The Mighty Boosh back in the day, brings to these movies is really remarkable. I mean, he is paying some pretty serious homage to Wes Anderson, to what was the other more classic reference point that I was thinking about yesterday, older than Wes Anderson. I can't. There's a lot of Buster Keaton. There's the whole last set piece is a riff on The General. There's a great sequence involving a bucket that feels ripped right out of vintage Chaplin. And then there's a scene in prison involving the gears of a clock tower that is straight up a nod to modern times. It's just so beautifully done. It's so funny. It's so smart. Hugh Grant, who was nominated for a fucking BAFTA for his performance in this movie, is incredible. And Phoenix Buchanan, Sally Hawkins, if she deserves an Oscar for starring in a movie about taming a wild animal who really has love in his heart and makes the world better for everyone around him, it's this, and definitely not The Shape of Water. This is a superior movie in every way, and they have a hell of a lot in common. This is a richer, more imaginative, more adult in some ways experience that is not nearly as flimsy with how it treats its villainy or uses its backdrop. This is going to be one of the best movies of the year. It was beloved when it opened in the UK late last year. I couldn't be more sincere. I know it's a fucking kids movie with an animated CGI animated bear who's voiced by Ben Whishaw and wears a red hat and has a real hankering for marmalade. But it is like a straight up masterpiece, and you need to go see Paddington 2.
Yeah, this is also, I imagine, partially boosted the author Michael Bond, who started writing the Paddington series in 58, died last summer.
Yeah.
And so I think the last Paddington book comes out this year for the 50th anniversary. And then that will be the original, the close of the original Paddington legacy. So I'm interested to, I'm interested to see a Brexit movie that has, you know, allusions to classic film and Wes Anderson. That I'm sold on.
I mean, it has. I was going to say, I mean, not just Wes Anderson, but the whole film is sort of inflected with this pop-up book aesthetic, you know, obviously reflective of the film's key prop. But it's so thorough. It's so well done. There isn't a moment that is wasted visually. It's pretty. Anyway, what was your reservation going to be?
Oh, I'm just interested to see how much I'm able to feel I could engage with, despite it being such like a purely English thing. It sounds like in your description, it could be slightly culturally different, but I'm not saying necessarily in a bad way. I'm excited to see that for myself.
I don't know. I sort of took for granted. I mean, of course, it goes without saying that it is more of a referendum on Brexit than on Trump. It, you know, Brexit was in the waters for a while and Trump came later, and this is an English product and is narcissistic as it comes with the territory of being an American. There's an ocean between us. But be that as it may, you are able to, in a one-to-one fashion, apply this film's message to what is happening in our country right now in a way that is, you know, in an apolitical stance, in a sense, it's very easy for kids to digest. Elise and I saw this in a sold out crowd, even if the movies were underperforming in New York on a Saturday afternoon. Of course, it was sold out. And the kids were the rowdy audience of kids were like locked the fuck in. And we heard their parents on the way out. I heard like at least three different parents saying something to the effect of it was even better than the first one. And these are people that I would imagine at home are watching Paddington on like a weekly basis, alternating it with Frozen and whatnot. So I think that nothing is getting lost over the ocean. And I mean, it's just such a fucking beautiful movie. And like, maybe I'm more susceptible to movies that are this open-hearted and sincere in a way that doesn't feel false or condescending these days. And I've always been a bit of a sucker for movies that are, I mean, this has plenty of conflict, but that are in that Magic Mike XXL vein, which are really sort of unabashed celebrations of the best things and the bonds between people. And don't muddy the waters too much with any sort of greater darkness, and where like everyone serves their purpose, everyone gets their moment. I mean, the way this script is arranged so that like every detail of every supporting character comes back in its moment of need. It really sort of embarrasses M. Night Shyamalan in Signs, which is always the classic example for me of of like throwing the fucking baseball or whatever. Or swinging away. Swing away, Denny. This movie just rules. It like flat out rules. I mean, I don't know. Go and if you go and see it and you don't like it, at least you have the satisfaction of thinking I'm even more of an idiot asshole than you might already. So points against me, always valuable. But I'm willing to take that bet.
Just like do the post, just to like get it out of the way, then watch Jumanji, then The Greatest Showman, then Paddington 2, and just like ramp up positivity heading into February. And
what the hell is happening with Jumanji? I mean, I am not, I think critics sometimes forget how bad we are at anticipating what is going to catch on with America, because we're so in our own worlds, and you know, we have to see everything. So and I think that interest is sometimes lost on us. But I would not have predicted that Jumanji would have connected with people in the way that it seems to, which is not to say that they're loving the movie necessarily, but they're all certainly interested in seeing it. I mean, $300 million domestically is insane.
Yes.
Do you, I mean, other than the fact that, as we've talked a lot about it around the release of 10 Cloverfield Lane, that people, any sort of, even the faintest hint of brand recognition is something that American audiences seem to need to motivate them to go to the theater. And once you're there, that you can sort of Trojan horse them anything, but they need they need that because they're not adventurous enough, generally speaking, to get out the door and spend $40 or whatever the fuck it costs to see a movie these days.
I mean, it has enough legs. I don't even think it's that. I think it's just every couple of years you need a body swapping comedy for the teenagers. And this year or last year it was Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle. I think there's just a place for a well-written body swapping adventure comedy or a Freaky Friday or what have you, like every once in a while. I think it's just, yeah. If I thought it was like building a universe or like important in some sort of like franchise narrative way, I would have been the first person out the door to see it.
Oh, it's not.
Here it's just like semi enjoyable with some good jokes.
It's like instantly forgettable. It is like so barely even connected to the original Jumanji. And there's like a half second allusion to Robin Williams' character. The Rock was in another property similar to this, less family friendly by far, with Baywatch, which bombed in the same year. And, you know, maybe it was just the good fortune of being something that families could all go see together over Christmas, where almost everything that came out did pretty well. You got The Greatest Showman nearing $100 million now and dropping like 10% every weekend, which is nuts. And also the number one selling album in America. Yeah, Jumanji. I don't know, man. I don't know.
It's also weird that it basically wiped Nick Jonas from the advertising when you think that that would be like part of what would help it tap into whatever it tapped into. But
yeah, who needs Nick Jonas? I could have played that fucking role. The movie would have made just as much money. I mean, it would have gotten even worse reviews. But he shows up halfway through and he's like, "Hey, I'm Nick Jonas," and what's her face is like, "Hey, Nick Jonas." Or is she? I can't even remember. Is she supposed to be? Oh, she is a girl, right? She doesn't gender swap, and gender swap only Jack Black does. Oh well. I also feel like I'm souring a little bit on The Rock, a little bit.
When did you think you started souring on The Rock?
It doesn't help that he hasn't been in anything that's really moved the needle for me in a while. In Pain and Games a long time ago, and Fast and Furious movies are super stale. I didn't see Baywatch, but I hear it's not good. And I'm certainly not watching fucking Ballers, but there's just something about his brand that is starting to feel a little tainted to me. There's something a little hoorah, a little right wing, but not in a Trumpish sense, of course, but I don't know. There's a little darkness there. I noticed it, especially in some of the interviews that he did for Jumanji. He was like on Kimmel with Jack Black, and there's just like a little, I don't know. No, I can't put my finger on it. Maybe I'll figure it out with Rampage or whatever else he has in the pipe.
But, I'm already beyond that. I just saw the last Fast movie, and I'm like, I'm done getting lured into The Rock movies. If something comes, I don't even know what it would take to have me come back. Like, obviously I didn't take the time to see Jumanji, so it's not outward success, but it's like, I feel, I came to the realization that you're feeling, but strongly, around the time in the newsroom where I was reminded that The Rock knew that Osama bin Laden was dead before the rest of us.
Oh, so you, I was going to say, you mean the HBO show, The Newsroom, but you do actually mean the HBO show.
Mean the HBO show, The Newsroom. In their episode, they have reminded me that The Rock tweeted out that Osama bin Laden was dead, sort of clandestinely, but not enough. Everybody sort of caught on. And I was like, the fucking Rock. And then, like, people were like, maybe he's going to run for office. And I'm like, he's definitely going to be a Republican if he does. And it's like, I don't like Arnold Schwarzenegger because Terminator 2 is a good movie. And then he ran for, like, governor. Like, that doesn't make me like Arnold Schwarzenegger movies anymore.
While we're living in this bizarre reality where celebrities are the only viable candidates for president, my vote goes to Oprah well before it goes to The Rock.
I mean,
this is someone who we obviously haven't heard. So we're living in the dumbest fucking timeline. any of their policies for anything. And Oprah, I will point out, is responsible for both Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz who are both cancers on this society, but I'm still willing to throw in my lot with her.
There was a time where, you know, Dwayne Johnson coming into his own as an actor and coming out of professional wrestling, I'm 100% on his side. Like, you go out, you make that money, you become the highest paying, you know, whatever actor. That's all great. It's when that, like, pinnacle is reached, what you do with it, that always sort of, like, makes me wary of superstardom. Like, you know, the Tom Cruises and the Tom Hanks, the Toms. Yeah. You keep, like, one eye on them, and it's like Tom Cruise is, like, buying people food and going out of his way to not mention Scientology until he suddenly does, and then Tom Hanks is like, I have a typewriter book and a typewriter app. And would you like to interview me about typewriters?
I mean, Tom Hanks really seems like he's doing it right. I mean, that's the beat on Tom Hanks. I mean, I think
it's a stay in your laneness that I demand of my stars. That I don't know if it's fair or not, but it's definitely there.
But Tom Hanks seems to really enjoy being Tom Hanks, which I think is something that I can't even say about Tom Cruise, because he seems to sort of be racked in. And by a number of different things that are, I don't know, hard for us to identify. But, you know, he's embroiled in Scientology. His career has had scandal, or whatever passed for scandal once upon a time. But Tom Hanks always seems like he's having fun. I was at the NBR Awards last week, and Tom Hanks presented, I think he was presenting Meryl Streep with Best Actress. I can't remember, but he... I don't know. He's giving off that vibe, same vibe he always does, but live and in living color and dropping F-bombs. And it was just like seeing him in the I Really Like You Carly Rae Jepsen music video all over again.
Well, two Daves talking about two Toms and Jumanji 2.
Is that it? Is that all we got?
Unless you want to talk briefly about if you have any fond memories of the Cranberries, who suffered a horrible loss today when Dolores O'Riordan, their lead singer, died at the age of 45 unexpectedly, which triggered definitely a Cranberries song at the end of this podcast, but a day full of me remembering, while we're talking about Tom Cruise, sort of being slow to pick up on the Cranberries until Dreams jumped out of the Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack I had on... It was Mission Impossible 1 soundtrack I had on cassette tapes.
Which is a great way of confessing that you are such a Philistine that you did not see Chungking Express in theaters when it opened, which of course I did not because I was 10 years old. But Chungking Express, Wong Kar-wai's film, used Dreams very, very heavily, repeatedly, as Wong Kar-wai is known to do. And that is the movie that I will always associate with the Cranberries and that song in particular. It's definitely a better use of it than in any of the Mission Impossible movies. But
wasted in the movie. I just remember that like I was buying my access to music at that time were soundtrack and inspired by albums of like tape cassettes. Like I remember listening to like Speed soundtrack and a whole bunch of like John Williams tapes that my dad had. It was an interesting time in young Dave's lifestyle, and the Cranberries were part of the return to real people music just in time to be a moody teenager.
when all these celebrities seem to start really dying in clusters in 2016, I sort of, for my own well-being, I just decided that I only have so much bandwidth that I can. I mean, I'm saddened, especially for somebody so young, immensely by these losses. But as far as like really getting into my feelings and like going on the internet and sharing my favorite things, I just think that because we, starting in the baby boomer generation and the technology that coincided with it, are going to have so many more famous people, we're going to lose so many more famous people. And I can't afford, you know, I've got my own life and losses to deal with. I can't afford to spend every day on the internet lamenting losses that I privately feel very sad about. And this is my long-winded way of saying that, like, I didn't feel like I had earned the right to really publicly say goodbye to the lead singer of the Cranberries, because Dreams is a huge song for me, like a huge song. And you know, Zombie and like one or two other of their massive singles. But I don't think that I could name you at least now, I couldn't name you their albums. I mean, yeah, I remember the 90s. That's what I grew up. But like, I felt like this sucks, but I would be lying if I said that I was ever going to be listening to new Cranberries material. Not that it makes it suck any less.
Well, it's interesting because like Tragedies become my Spotify or whatever the shit it is, because like until this happened, I was just like occasionally listening to the new Justin Timberlake and the new Andrew WK, like bouncing back and forth.
But then they both died, and now you're
well, I mean, that's what February holds, is the Justin Timberlake's final Super Bowl performance before we sacrifice him to the Jaguar God of the Sun. But it's interesting that that was a weird way to get an earworm or a series of earworms, but then led down a hole of the album I remembered, which is Everybody Else Is Doing It, So Why Can't We, which was the cassette tape that I was led to through weirdo Tom Cruise making a fun movie.
Yeah.
Like Bible illusions and spies based on a TV series that I never saw.
When Alexander Hamilton died, I fucking crushed the Hamilton score and soundtrack like day in and day out for months at a time. But I can't only listen to the music of the dearly departed.
When Alexander Hamilton died?
it was a tired was like, humor.
I just wanted to make sure it was a joke and not I had forgotten
for
somebody died.
Underlining how poorly that joke landed.
I was like, does he think that Lin-Manuel Miranda's dead? And I was going to have to...
Oh no, I'm way too afraid of Mary Poppins the Return or whatever the fuck to keep tabs on that guy. I think it is clearly a tragedy that she died, and her songs are, at least some of them are branded on my brain in a way that will, you know, dementia could never take them away at this point. So and it sounds like I was really doing myself a disservice by not knowing more of her music, that's too bad. Sad.
Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. That's a pretty good mini-sode between two Daves fighting in the war room. But before we go, I'm going to guess at some point our co-hosts guiltily get around to this. So, David, what should be Little Eleanor's first movie? It doesn't matter when it is, but what's the first movie?
I mean... This is not an opinion. I mean, this is a fact. I've road tested this on my nieces, and it worked brilliantly for them. The answer for Eleanor and for all children should be My Neighbor Totoro. And that should probably be the only movie that they watch for a couple years there, from like 2.5, 3 to 4-ish. My niece just graduated. She's like 4.5 now, just graduated to Ponyo. And I think that went okay. She was a little frightened at times. I think her parents were a little frightened at times. And there was a lot of confusing talk about ham, but the next morning she woke up and demanded to have her face painted like Ponyo's mom, and she had her wish granted. So that was a success. I look forward to taking her or showing her Paddington 2 one day. But Little Eleanor, if you're listening, and I know you are, My Neighbor Totoro, that's your first movie.
That's pretty good. I was going to go with Fantasia like a weirdo, because why deal with plot? But if David's probably right, you should probably go directly into cinema and then let your, you know, father's crazy obsession with film scores take you the rest of the way to Fantasia.
There's not much plot to speak of in My Neighbor Totoro, to be fair. It's like,
no, you know, that's true.
Yeah, their mom's sick, they meet a forest spirit, there's a cat bus, and so on.
Well, more so than, well, I guess we don't have to talk about Fantasia, and we definitely don't have to talk about more children's movies. So, David, until next week, where can people find more of your work on the
internet? Well, it will probably be until the week after next week, because on Wednesday of this week, I am going off to Sundance, where I will be for 9 days. writing about the indies, hoping to see another Call Me By Your Name, and probably not, but maybe settling for another The Big Sick, Ghost Story. I don't know. Those are all
just
pretty
hope
special.
For something that's Paddington 2 or better.
I will. That's not going to happen, though, is the problem. Like, I literally was – I was having dinner with my wife after Paddington 2, obsessively regurgitating every moment of Paddington 2. And I mentioned to her that the likelihood that I'll see anything in Sundance this special is slim. I will say as a tease that of the 7 or 8 Sundance movies from this year I've already seen, a lot of them were whatever. One of them was pretty mind-blowing. And I really look forward to digging into it. So we got that to look forward to. But you can find me on Twitter, David Ehrlich. You can find me on IndieWire, writing about stuff. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
Yeah, you can.
And you probably you can find, like, I don't know if Patches wants to, but photos of little Eleanor. I don't know if he's cool with that or if he's one of those dads who's like, I don't want to share. I don't want you to see photos of little Eleanor and use her for your sick games.
Yeah, I was going to wait. I was waiting for the day she was born for him to tweet something so I could retweet it.
Should we bleep out her name? Have we already said too much?
I think this is fine.
Named after the ELE from Deep Impact?
I could only Ellie? Hope so. Yeah. That makes perfect sense. That we were talking about Deep Impact right before she was born. Because I bet
that's like one of those movies Patches loves, right?
Well, we were talking about how I have a zombie apocalypse plan living in Denver and how that covers a lot of different end of the world situations because my plan involves going to the mountains, which would also keep me out of a Deep Impact wave, as we learned in Deep Impact. So hopefully...
I thought of Deep Impact a lot this weekend with the false alarm that spread throughout Hawaii.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, there have been stories to this effect, many of them that we've seen that media outlets cover about how horrifying and traumatic those 38 minutes must have been. But I just can't stop thinking about the gulf between how I feel reading those and how horrifying it truly must have been in a way that I can't quite wrap my head around. And whatever, like, no, trying to figure out, like, what degree of skepticism I would have about whether or not this was real. I think
what
probably,
do you even do if it is real? Yeah. Like, how do you take shelter from a ballistic missile?
That's what we learned, is that, like, people had, like, hidden closets, like that was going to do anything, and called their loved one. I mean, it just sounds, I feel like there needs to be, like, congressional hearings about this. Like, there needs to be some sort of compensation. I mean, like, the psychic damage that it was due to an entire island of people is, I think, hard for those of us to those of us who were not involved to really understand. It's crazy. Anyway.
It is. It made me think about what's the one? War Games? Or the computer. Matthew Broderick accidentally almost starts a nuclear war by playing internet games.
Yeah, the producers.
Yeah, the producers. Exactly. It's exactly like the producers. And that's the scariest thing of all. I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find back episodes of this podcast at fightinginthewarroom.com. You could find my other podcast at stormofspoilers.com. We're going to be talking about Michael Crichton this week. And please follow the show on Twitter at FITWR, where maybe there will be photos of a baby if we decide that baby privacy is not of our concern. But of course, we're going to leave that up to the parents. Be great
and
to each other.
Leave us reviews or you're going to be stuck with just me and Dave forever.
I'm more like this episode's given me the confidence that you and I could do a morning show where structure wasn't important, but just like filling the time was, because I enjoyed talking to you. I just also feel like as the person who's going to have to edit this later, it's like there's no segments.
Where like every time you tried to throw it to a commercial, I was like, hey, how about that time when everyone in Hawaii thought they were about to be nuclear annihilated?
No, it's, I mean, I'm all in favor of the free form David talking, but yes, leave us reviews. Why not? It's going to be interesting to see what you thought about this episode.
We've already covered how the free form David talking wasn't ideal. So don't need to pile on.
Yeah, but until next week, enjoy whatever it is you're taking in of the pop culture, and we'll talk to you soon.